people, welcome to Private Equity Laid Bare, the podcast. My guest today is James Ranger. And James is a good friend of mine, and he's a banker. Yes, bankers still exist, and I have one on the line. So, James, welcome. And just please say a word or two about what you do in life.
Hi, Ludovic. It's a pleasure to be here. So I am, as you say, a banker, possibly a more endangered species in leveraged finance than we used to be. But I run the sponsors and structured finance group at Lloyds, which covers a variety of asset classes, but particularly focused on leveraged finance, both origination and distribution.
And basically, the reason I wanted to have you very badly on this podcast is because I'm very worried about you. You know, I've been knowing you for 15 years, and I'm really afraid that you may disappear indeed. So can you tell us where you still have stuff to do, like where these private debt people leave you some room to breathe, and like, you know, maybe give us an idea about where you were in 2008, the kind of things you were doing in 2008, and then what kind of things then you are left to do now?
It doesn't feel like I'm running out of things to do at the moment, that's for sure. But I think you make an important point. So, I mean, the rise of private debt, which I'm sure you've talked about on this podcast and certainly we've spoken about many times, has been astronomic, particularly in the last 6 or 7 years. But it was it started to emerge certainly around 2008, 2009, at the end of the global financial crisis, certainly in the UK. It had been around a little while longer in the US. But if I think back to what Lloyds did then, and if I then play forward to where the market is now, so 2007, 2008, the mid-market leverage finance space, so for us that in the UK, that's deals of up to around £250 million, was dominated particularly by the UK commercial banks. So the two biggest players were NatWest, or RBS as they were called then, and HBOS. Lloyds was active as well, though, in the mid-market. Barclays had a decent-sized mid-market leveraged finance business as well. And then there was a whole bunch of other banks. And generally, deals would be club deals. So the banks would get together if it was more than they could hold on their own. And it was quite a relationship-led, relatively cozy market. And banks built up pretty big balance sheets. In the larger end of the market, the underwriting distribution end of the market, so really anything above around 250 million of debt, again, bank-led, the investment banks would play as well as the commercial banks, and typically deals would be underwritten and then sold down either to other banks, but also to a very large CLO market, institutional debt market.
So basically, the size we're talking about is the size of a loan, right? So if a loan was up to 250, it was basically the commercial banks, and then beyond 250, you would source it, let's say, and then sell it to someone else, and this would be like an investment bank or CLOs or maybe directly to institutional investors, etc.
Absolutely, Vivek. So, and look, the size would move around depending on the client, but typically around 250 million would be around where you'd start to actively get into the underwrite and distribution market.
And this debt would be only senior, or that would also include junior, i.e. you would be doing the whole thing and then just saying, okay, I will find somebody else to buy the junior part and I keep the senior part, even like for the smaller parts, or how would that work? What kind of debt were you giving?
So back before the financial crisis, banks were actively holding both senior debt and mezzanine debt on their balance sheets. So we may syndicate some, but we could hold both senior debt. We would hold mezzanine debt at Lloyds. Some of the other banks would be far more aggressive in terms of holding bigger junior debt positions.
In the US, sorry, it was not quite like that, right? In the US, you would have like a junk bond market that would be pretty big.
So in the US market, yes, more established high yield bond market. I mean, to be fair, there was also a high yield bond market in Europe as well at the time, but nowhere near as sizable as the US high yield bond market. You did have funds, so you had, if you like, the precursors to a lot of the private debt funds, but they typically tended to play in mezzanine debt. So they wanted yields above 10%. They might take equity warrants in the deals as well. And we may sell, we might underwrite and sell mezzanine to them. We might underwrite and hold mezzanine ourselves. But typically,
okay, so
it was
you were competing with them already. On that legal tranche.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Yeah, we were competing. I mean, we the scale of those funds was far, far smaller than the size and the punching power of the banks back then. So it didn't feel as intense as perhaps the competition with private debt is today. But yes, they were a part of the ecosystem, and on certain deals, particularly smaller deals, they may compete. But typically they were providing mezzanine and the banks would continue to provide senior. And in the mid-market, which is where the private debt funds have established themselves, there wasn't really any alternative to a bank-led deal.
Yeah, so that's a below 250. But the CLO is still around, right? So you could still do like all this underwriting and then selling to CLOs. Is that still something you do, or private debt funds have come into that space, compete with a CLO and then shrink you because you were giving the deals to CLOs?
Yeah, so the CLOs absolutely still exist, or CLOs 2.0, as they tended to be called after the global financial crisis. They still exist. They're a big part of the market, and all of these big jumbo deals like Asda or INEOS or the other deals you'll see in the headlines at the moment will be sold, or large portions of those deals will be sold to the CLOs. The difference between a CLO and a private debt fund is a CLO typically needs to invest in liquid and rated paper. So typically the borrower will need to go and get a public or sometimes a private, but a rating from two of the three rating agencies. And typically those CLOs will want the debt overall debt size to be big enough so that they can trade in and out of that paper, so they can sell and buy. That means they tend to... Sorry, Ludo.
Yeah, sorry. And you're still the main purveyor of it to these guys, right? You're still the one who's sourcing most of the deals to the CLO people.
Correct. So the banks will underwrite and sell into the CLO market. We will help our clients get a rating on the deal if they don't have one already. We'll structure that deal. The CLOs do not want to be direct lenders. So they, unlike the private debt funds who want to be interfacing directly with the borrower, the CLOs want a prepackaged deal with a bow around it where everything is done, the deal's been done, and they can just buy a tranche of that deal and then either hold it or trade it on to other people in the market.
That's leaving you some space. You then have a reason to exist then as this origination person.
For sure. So the larger end of the market, and I would say those liquid deals tends to still be 250 million sterling equivalent is a good benchmark size. Where the private debt funds have come in, though, and taken massive market share as an asset class, and particularly from the banks, is in that mid-market, so sub 250 million of debt space, where the banks were preeminent before 2008.
Because above the 250, you also have, in Europe, the high-yield market that has developed, and so it means that on both of these things, the banks then are playing quite a big role, because if it's something above 250, either you originate for a CLO or you may underwrite for a public offering of a debt. So the bank is playing quite a big role still on that place, right?
Yes, they are. And the banks are still the preeminent underwriters. However, you are beginning to see that come under pressure. And that's really, so if you think about the last 10 years, the first sort of 6 or 7 years, private debt came into Europe after the financial crisis. Banks were put under a lot of pressure to reduce the riskier parts of their balance sheet, and leverage finance obviously was one of the areas that came under a lot of regulatory challenge. That opened up some blue space for the funds, the private debt funds, to come into in the mid-market. So really by about 2018, the funds had taken, depending on which stats you look at, but roughly 50% of all mid-market deals were being led by private debt funds. So the banks have lost a lot of share in that market. Not all of it unintentionally. I mean, we have been under pressure to reduce our exposure in leverage finance. So Lloyds, in 2008-09, Lloyds and HBOS combined probably had a balance sheet of over 10 billion in leverage finance loans, predominantly mid-market. Today, we'd be closer to 2.5 billion. So we have massively reduced our exposure to that asset class, and the funds have come in. But really, the story of the last 3 or 4 years, and perhaps the story of the next 3 or 4 years, will be increasing competition between the private debt funds and the banks at the larger end of the market.
Go ahead.
So I was going to say, so you see the private debt funds now, if you think about an Ares, so I know I think you've had Blair on this podcast before,
It's coming
very
next.
big funds raising $10 billion funds, they can now write checks of up to $1 billion. We've seen some of these private debt funds writing checks for 500 to $1 billion. That competes head on with either a high yield bond or with an underwritten deal into the CLOs. So that really is where the battleground is beginning to be fought between commercial banks, investment banks, and the debt funds for share of borrower minds.
And so I think it's pretty clear above 250. I'm quite surprised on below 250 that the banks still have 50% shares, because you said you had to lower your risk and everything, but you still have an entire capital structure here to finance. You have some junior play, you have some junior tranches, senior tranches, etc. And the banks, even below 250, can they hold like the junior tranches of debt?
No, they can't. They can't hold the junior tranches. But
so what do they do then? How do you manage?
So the competition's quite interesting. So in that lower end of the market, banks are offering a completely different product to the funds. So the private debt funds, as you know, are offering unitranche. Now, all a unitranche is a single tranche of debt that replaces where we were back at the start of this story in 2007, with banks providing senior debt and then mezzanine debt. All that happened is the funds have blended that together to create one tranche, say, of 6 or 7% yield, which is more levered than a bank would typically provide senior debt. So what the banks are offering today and what we continue to offer is a lower levered structure to private equity to finance their deals, but a cheaper structure. So the question really for the client today is, do they want the extra leverage that they can get from a private debt fund? But remember that the incremental cost, if I can lend them 4 times leverage at 4% margins, and a fund can do 5 to 6 times leverage at 6 or 7% margins, then that incremental cost of that extra turn or two of leverage is often in the mid-teens. And that's obviously the price at which the private equity house would like to deploy equity. So actually you get some really interesting debates about whether people want more leverage at higher cost, or if they want a lower geared, cheaper bank deal. Okay, and that's really the debate.
I was going to guess that the numbers would be, if you want up to 3 times EBITDA, you go to GEMS and you get an unbeatable deals. But if you really want to go to 6 times EBITDA, then you need to go to a private debt fund. You're going to pay the price for that. And so then you'll have to think whether the marginal gain is worth a marginal cost. But you're saying that you would be relaxed up to 4 times EBITDA, and then these guys would be more like 6 times? Is that small?
It's all very credit related, Lula. So it depends on the quality of the underlying borrower and the strength of the credit. We will lend on a senior debt basis, sometimes up to 5 times leverage in senior debt. But what you typically expect is the unitranche would be at least a turn, usually a turn and a half to 2 turns more levered than the equivalent senior. So it's usually a turn to 2 turns differential in leverage that you can get.
What
from
do
the
you
two
mean
options.
By terms?
Sorry, turn of EBITDA, so times EBITDA, of leverage. But that's not really the end of the story in terms of it's not a binary competition. So the other reason the banks are still very, very relevant to the market, and in my view are here to stay, is you still need banks in a deal, even if you're doing a private debt deal. And the reason you need banks, partly because companies need working capital facilities, they need what we call revolving credit facilities, RCFs. Private debt funds hate providing those because they don't like capital that has to recycle debt that can be redrawn. That's quite hard with a fund structure. And also, companies want the ancillaries that a bank provides. So if you need clearing, if you need corporate credit cards, if you need trade finance, if you need supplier finance, all of that stuff,
fintech,
merchant acquiring.
There are some small fintech firms that offer all of that for like a fraction of the cost, no?
Not really yet. I mean, maybe that's where the world goes. But if you look at the corporate banking market in terms of those ancillary products, it's still vastly
for
dominated
large companies, on the smaller end, it's a bit more.
Perhaps at the smaller end, but for commercial, sort of, if you like, 5 million of EBITDA and bigger companies, mid-market and large cap companies. So, but for a bank to provide that, they need security. They need to be carved out of the capital structure. So what you tend to find is on any private debt fund deal, there is still an ask for a bank to provide what we call a super senior RCF. So something that is less risky than the unitranche because the banks don't want to play in that more highly geared part of the structure. It will sit at the top of the tree in terms of its priority over any security that's raised in an acceleration. And the banks are needed. So every single private debt fund tends to still need a bank around it. And that's why the banks are still relevant there. And now we're starting to see more and more hybrids coming into the market as well. So the other way to structure one of these deals, and it's sort of back to the future in terms of where we were in 2007, is to create what we call a hybrid unitranche or a first loss, second loss tranche, which is where the borrower says, well, actually, I want a private debt fund because I want the extra leverage, but actually I want a bank in the deal as well, perhaps relationship, perhaps ancillary product, but also, frankly, a bank can lend money generally cheaper than a fund. So it'll ask the bank to do the second loss tranche, perhaps the first, if you like, 40% of the capital structure, and then it'll ask the fund to do what they call the first loss tranche, effectively junior debt, but yes, turned on its head because the junior debt is bigger. Yeah. So we have a really interesting relationship with private debt. We compete with them, we partner with them, and then the third part of the puzzle as well is I actually have private debt as my client because I have a very big fund finance business. So the other opportunity for banks is to lend bridge facilities, gearing facilities, leverage facilities to private debt funds themselves. So
yeah, it's
an interesting relationship.
I was going to bring this up because this is not only to private debt funds that you give all these subscription lines and the like, right? So it is also all the private market funds. So this business has been booming for banks, right?
It's a very successful asset class, and you're absolutely right. It all began with private equity rather than private debt. So private equity have been using subscription lines, as you know, for a long time, a couple of decades. But those sort of facilities are now also clearly used by the private debt industry as well.
Yeah, and are there some funds as well in the private debt market that actually borrow in order to lend more? So like a bit like these BDCs in the US, right? Then they would probably borrow from a bank in order to lend more to a company, effectively recreating a junior and senior tranche, no?
It is leverage, absolutely, but leverage at a different part of the structure, absolutely.
Yeah, so you also provide some debt to things like BDCs and the like, and therefore you're also lending to like these private debt funds.
That's right. We do lend to the private debt funds. I mean, typically for Lloyds, we tend to be lending secured on their LP commitments. So we're not lending looking down, we're lending looking up into the fund. But yeah, absolutely. That's why I mean that private debt, as well as a competitor, as well as a partner, they also can be a client of ours.
No, but what I was wondering was whether you don't also like lend to the fund for deployment. So let me take an example. A fund has 100 million that they raise from LPs to lend, but then they will borrow another 100 million from, let's say, a bank in order to lend 200 million in unitranches. Would that happen or not?
It can happen. So that's what we would call gearing or a leverage facility. So they're effectively leveraging up the capital they've raised to lend more. Typically, I mean, for us, we don't tend to play in that part of the market. Typically, subscription lines or bridging facilities, as they're called in Europe, tend to be put in place to give the fund more operational flexibility. So rather than every time they do a deal, they have to go to 100 LPs, it's something that allows them to just do drawdowns maybe twice a year, sometimes once a year. Yeah. But clearly, even delaying your drawdown because for operational purposes, still will help your IRR.
Yeah, tremendously, especially at the beginning of fund's life. And people should not use IR, but they seem to be addicted. So yes. I think it's more of a US thing as well to provide fund leverage, like to have private debt funds that are levered themselves.
It is. And interestingly, Ludo, it's much more common in the US market, and actually, historically in Europe, European LPs have been far less comfortable with leveraging private debt funds. So you often see some private debt funds who might have one strategy that's US LP-led that will be levered, and one strategy that's European LP-led that may be unlevered.
Yeah. It's a puzzling thing because if you lever up a private debt fund that does unitranche, what you have done effectively is that you have recreated a junior and senior structure. So when you are committing money to a levered private debt fund, you are effectively investing in a junior debt fund, even though the fund tells you, I do unit tranche and it's secured, blah, blah, blah. Because they have debt on the fund, you are effectively holding a junior tranche.
For sure. And my advice to an LP would always be, look at the returns that you're being promised by the fund. If they're promising you double digit returns or close, then by definition you are investing in junior debt rather than senior debt, which would typically have a much lower yield.
Or somebody gives you a low return and you are in junior debt, they just charge a lot more fees. But usually indeed that'll be the case. Actually it's always this good rule of thumb and common sense. And I have a student of mine who I was very proud of. There was a scandal recently, right? This Grace Hill problem, and my student was close to it. And then I asked her. I said, like, did you advise your clients to invest in there? What did you do? And she said, no. I was like, well, I'm the only one in my group or not to advise my clients, because you know I saw it right away. Like, they were promising something like 5-6% return and say like they were investing in like AAA or commercial paper only, and it was not possible. And so there was something else. So I think it's a good thing to always think, you know, with common sense, just like this. One last question maybe about subscription lines. It seems to me that they are quite expensive for what they are. I guess you would call it high margin products on your side. And I'm puzzled by that because they seem to be so risk-free. It seems that, you know, basically an LP never defaults. You will always get your subscription line repaid as a banker. Why is it so expensive?
Well, it depends on how you view the expense. I mean, generally, subscription lines, if you like, relatively vanilla subscription lines will still be priced at probably 150 to 180 basis points over LIBOR or SONIA. So I wouldn't say they're nowhere near the price of raising leverage. If you think of it from a private equity perspective, so if you wanted to raise leverage at the portfolio company level, you're probably talking at least twice that. But you're right, the subscription line is typically secured on the LP, so it should be secured on fairly high quality credit counterparty. And the track record for that industry is very strong. So there's been very few instances of loss. But it is still a product that comes with risk. I mean, typically one risk you always have, and there has been some headlines on this in recent years, is fraud risk. So if the GP defrauds its LPs, you may be put in a position where the LP doesn't pay because there's fraud in the fund and the bank, therefore you can be exposed. So you still need to do your diligence on the GP quality and integrity and track record. We always face into the risk in a subscription line of the can't pay, won't pay scenario. So there is obviously the fund has protections against an LP not funding, but there is always a risk that the LP decides not to pay and takes the litigation risk or takes the risk of not being eligible for any more capital redemption. But if it's a fund that has underperformed so badly that the fund's loss making, then you could be in a position where an LP could refuse to pay. So there's a risk there. And there's always, I guess, some systemic risk in this that if an LP has a problem, then you might have that LP might have that problem across multiple facilities. So there's a little bit of correlation risk you run as a subscription
lender. We discussed that, right, together once at the crisis, saying, you know, like if one LP will default, you probably would have all of them defaulting.
So I think there's always risk in these products. The other part of this product, which is important to understand, is they can be quite challenging operationally to manage. I mean, as you would expect with a private equity fund or a private debt fund who's using subscription lines, multiple drawdowns, multiple repayments, multiple currencies.
Sure. And it happens randomly, right? They may call you for a big number saying like, oh, I'm just making an acquisition. I need like 50 million more, right?
Exactly. So there's a level of operational infrastructure that needs to come alongside providing these sorts of facilities. So look, I don't think you'd ever find me arguing that they're underpriced. I think there is certainly some risk that comes with
it. Do you take fees on top of that, or you just charge 1.5%, or are there like a fixed fees for like taking them up?
There are fees involved, but they're much smaller than you'd see in sort of other asset classes.
Okay, so I think it's clear why you're so busy, right? I mean, you do have quite a lot of work.
It is a busy time, and look, I think the banks will continue to be busy in leveraged finance. I think you will see an interesting dynamic over the years to come as to whether private debt funds continue to take market share, whether we reach, if you like, a natural equilibrium where borrowers have the choice of private debt or a bank-led balance sheet deal or a capital markets deal. And you may see the market just evolve into more choice. And I think that can only be good for the borrowers at the end of the day. And we'll have to drive more efficiency for all of the players in the market. I think the other element, which will be really interesting to see how it evolves, you know, is whether the banks start to raise third-party capital themselves. And we're starting to see this. So HSBC have announced a private debt fund of their own. We would certainly, it would be odd if we weren't considering those sort of strategic options as a bank at the moment. And if you look at a world where there is enormous amounts of liquidity looking to get into alternatives, whether that's debt or equity, and banks have big origination platforms, they have stellar track records, hopefully they have stellar track records, we certainly think we do, and they have big client bases. So if banks can't provide leverage finance in the scale that they used to from their own balance sheets, well, there is the option for banks to start to create their own debt funds and really take the debt funds on themselves.
We would be back to a future again, because the banks started in private, and most of private equity outside of the US was started by banks, right? I mean, Nomura started private equity, you know, like Permira came out of a bank, like all the private equity in Europe was, and in Asia, and like was out of banks. And then the banks, they spun out their private equity arms. And then now you say now they're going to bring in a private debt arm into a bank. So
It is fascinating how the world evolves. Although I must mention that Lloyds still owns its own private equity firm with LDC, Lloyds Development Capital, that's still a captive. But you're absolutely right. But there is a logic, and it's sort of the same logic to why Lloyds continues to own a private equity firm, is that it is an important product that our clients want to have access to. So there's certainly strategic sense to it, but you need to be able to do it in a way that is profitable in the context of the regulatory cost of capital you have to hold against these asset classes.
Yeah. Okay, fantastic. Well, I'm reassured, because I was really afraid that you may get out of work and you know, and then I would have to like cycle the world around the world with you. But apparently you're very busy, so I'm highly reassured. Do take a break to cycle. That's important to keep up. Okay, so this was Bankers Laid Bare. Thank you so much, James, for joining again. People, don't forget to subscribe, and congratulations on your acquisition of one more piece of knowledge. Ciao, ciao.